WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's a long walk from Washington State to Washington, D.C., particularly when you don't take the most direct route. But George Troop isn't interested in how quick he can make the journey. He's focused on the impact he might have as a result of what he calls his pilgrimage of inspiration. His indirect route from Washington to Washington has brought him to Charlotte, and he joins us later in the program to tell us why he's been hoofing it since 2009. First, another man on another mission. Mel Chin is artist in residence at McCall Center for Visual Art and hopes to turn art that resembles money into real money in an effort to rid New Orleans of hundreds of millions of dollars in lead pollution. Mel Chin joins us now to tell us more about that effort. Welcome to the program. Welcome to Charlotte.
It's great to be here.
You've been artist in residence at McCall Center, which is just about a block and a half away from us this morning, since September, and you'll be there till March. And we've had other artists in residence at that location and other entities around town. And I've never asked this question. How do you become an artist in residence? What does an artist in residence do?
Well, the prerequisite is to become an artist, I guess.
Of course.
And in this case, the McCall Center has given a great opportunity to explore studio work that has been waiting, especially since I'm involved in the largest national drawing project and democratic expression project in the country.
And that's the project we're going to talk about.
Yes,
today.
Yeah. So the residency has been instrumental in giving me some time to focus on that, as well as my own work that is always experimental.
Do you apply for things like that, or do they seek you out? I mean, do they know you? Obviously, people know your work in art circles.
In this case, I was fortunate to be sought, and it happened during a period of time when I was able to come in here. And the focus on Charlotte was of particular interest as well.
You were born in Houston, Texas. Where is home base today?
It's in a witness protection program. in the mountains of North Carolina. I was close by.
Okay. You were born in Houston. You're known for artworks that require collaborative teamwork and that kind of join together what is referred to.
Well, certain things. I mean, certain projects, of course, studio work that shows in museums and galleries are more expressions that can be a whole range of investigations from disaster to human rights abuse, and they can works that make commentary on political oppression, mm-hmm. and so those are, and there's also idiosyncratic works that have to happen, like cutting up every image of Funk and Wagnall's encyclopedia from 1953 and creating 524 collages called the Funk and Wag from A to Z. It took about a year to cut and paste and put down in paper, and it's a whole recombination of images that have lost their relationship to the words of the past.
And you know, my grandmother had the entire Funk and Wagnall's encyclopedia, and she gave it to us as children to mm-hmm. use in school. And I don't know what became of that. It was nicely bound, but I remember that most of the photographs, because it was not as big as the World Book or as the Encyclopedia Britannica. They're smaller books. And the images were smaller, and many of them were, I think, in black and white, weren't they?
They were. And I guess a project like this, you mentioned your grandmother, you know, I found a copy of it after my parents had, mm-hmm. had died. And in the face of death, you become creative, you mm-hmm. know. And it started, embarked on this journey that took about a year.
Wow. The project that you're involved in now is an extension of something that I guess you became interested in and kind of a crusader for years ago, green remediation. Since you're an artist, what's your interest in environmental cleanup?
Well, I only have done several environmental works, so it's incorrect to call me an environmental artist, but when I focus on things, it becomes of strong interest, mm-hmm. especially in levels where solutions are not readily available. In Revival Field, which you're speaking of, was the first, what I conducted, was the first replicated field test that helped scientists verify the technology that they only had proven in the labs. So Revival Field became the instigation where we provided data so that scientists could understand that and say truly that plants can remove heavy metals from the soil.
So explain this to me, because scientists had conducted these experiments in the laboratory. You put them in the field in this project called Revival Field in 1989, correct?
That is correct. In the 1990s, okay. 91, 92, 93, we provided the data from the field, because you can postulate things like cold fusion in a laboratory all you want, but you need to have it replicated in a field trial.
So why did they turn to an artist?
They did not. I had heard that there might be a chance that plants could transform toxins and pull them up, and I felt that that's an amazing premise and has a great poetry in that, and that you could do this. And it would be like a sculpture where you can transform environmental conditions to better than they were. And that could be a very, very pragmatic sculpture. But to go there, it required the expertise of those who knew, and very few knew at the time. But because of Revival Field, hundreds of scientists are now engaged in the field of green remediation or phytoremediation.
It took an artist and his different vision of the world?
Well, I'm a conceptual artist. Yeah, I don't know. It takes all of us, and it's very much like this problem that started in New Orleans and now is nationwide. You know, again, I don't go as an artist to pursue tragic events to be inspired. I think sometimes you go to help, and conditions reveal themselves that compel you into action.
Operation Pay Dirt is what you're involved in now, and the $100 bill project to remove lead-contaminated soil in New Orleans, with applications around the country, because New Orleans is not the only city. It's just
Absolutely.
The worst example of
it's one of the worst, yeah.
And as I understand this, you went to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. You were asked to come to see what you as an artist could offer? Is that right?
Well, in this case, it's not an artist in residency as great as in McCall. It's a condition where you as a citizen and a creative person might want to go down and see if you can offer anything of service. The effects were devastating, not just in a physical level of visiting a site like that, a city like that, but it was a psychological and social trauma that had been inflicted by the storm is what makes it difficult to come up with something. And so, therefore, it was almost like the magnitude of the disaster required a project of equal magnitude.
Wow. You toured the Ninth Ward, which I believe was the worst damaged part of the city.
Yes, I did. But I checked every ward. We're in Central City, and we went into areas where some of the most violent areas of so-called violent areas of New Orleans, and spoke with many people who had survived the storm or had been also equally impacted by the tragic
storm. So did they ask you to come, or did you just want to go to see what you could
do? I went down because someone I was lecturing at MIT, and instructor said, isn't it wonderful that some people are using the technology of Revival Field to clean heavy metals from the soil in New Orleans? So what would you say to them, especially lead pollution? And I told them to cease and desist, because plants don't – I know the plants that pick up certain heavy metals, but they do not pick up lead. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in going down to check it out and contribute.
You did, and you said that when you went down there you felt – I'm going to paraphrase here, hopeless and helpless and inadequate. You didn't know what, if anything, you could do to help. And you discovered, though, that the disaster was in the soil before the disaster.
That is correct. It's in the levels of there are – the EPA had indicated that it did not get worse. But the question that you have to ask, then how bad was it?
And why was it bad? Explain that. Do you understand?
It's in every city. It's probably here in Charlotte. It's in Philadelphia or Cincinnati or Cleveland or Oakland, California. It's paint. Lead was added to paint
right
since the early – this very beginnings here in industrial America.
And to gasoline.
And, yes, tetraethyl lead. And what happens is that as it ages and flakes and becomes dust, it's not so much the flake but the dust – gets into the soil, and then the exhaust from the cars overpasses and over communities mm-hmm. rains down this dust in very much nano-sized particle. And the consequence is that you have ingestion from the youngest members of your community, and then it gets into the blood and the brain and causes irreparable brain damage.
30% of the children you've discovered in New Orleans had lead poisoning prior to Hurricane Katrina.
Yes, that's true. Some indicate higher, but 30% of the inner city childhood mm-hmm. population, because the effects also is combined with issues like poverty, lack of nutrition can allow the lead to combine with the brain.
And what's the outcome of that in a
child? Well, it's basically your IQ drops. And then you also have behavioral disorders that can lead, as they've studied 30-year studies in Cincinnati, violent behavior, an increase in violent behavior.
Now, you've launched a project to help in the cleanup effort. That's a $300 million in cleanup.
Well, it could be more than that.
It could be more than that. Exactly right. But it seems daunting to clean it up just for a scientist or a city planner to go.
Well, for
an artist to do it seems.
Well, it's not. It's not me doing it. It's actually the people of America. The $100 bill. When I went and encountered this problem, yes, we talked about New Orleans would take that much, but now we've gone nationwide because we've already traveled 19,200 miles in our armored truck to pick up the 400,000 drawings we have so far. Because as any child or grandmother or parent or anybody that's interested in transforming this place, or not just New Orleans, but their own community could have a say in it. Especially in trying economic times, it was not proper to ask for money, mm-hmm. but maybe human expression, because that is essentially what would be jeopardized by a product such as this.
And because children are the ones most affected by this, is that because they're closer to the ground or because they're younger and their bodies are smaller? And
all of that. They're to the ground, and kids put their hands in their mouth.
Uh-huh.
And the dust, it is the dust, not the big paint flakes, not the things that affect mm-hmm. you. And we talk about a society that wants to be free of and have proper education and crime-free, and yet this is one material that affects all those aspects.
Right.
And so, you know, the project allows, the drawing project, you know, you can go to funder.org and you can download your own template and draw one, and you can contribute. You could draw one. And then it becomes, I transform from this artist position to delivery person. We're in that phase now, and that's some of the experiments that we're having here at the McCall Center, is to develop this idea of a funded reserve, even exchange bank. If we have $400,000, that's $40 million worth of value that we want to exchange to the scientific parameters and the educational methodologies to stop this and prevent this for every child in America. So this is what the project essentially is about, that every person can have a voice in this and have a valuable voice in a tangible form. So we can take it to legislators and say, well, not only has the voice of Americans been part of this, we also want to provide some of the scientific protocols that we have launched and given to your own agency, like the EPA Region 9, that launched 100 properties that have been transformed by the processes we gave to the EPA Region 9, which is the California emergency response team, to address an Oakland neighborhood heavily toxified, exactly like New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this possibility, and we want to back it up with expression.
Well, we have talked around exactly what this project is. When we come back from the break, we'll spell it out for people
yeah.
who are wondering exactly what are these drawings that you're talking about in this website that you go to download a template. What is all this about? How does it work? We'll do that when we come back. Mel Chin is artist in residence at the McCall Center for Visual Art. He's in charge of the $100 Bill Project. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Beckler Museum of Modern Art, now showing Giacometti, Memory and Presence, an exhibition of rare works revealing the evolution and emotional power of visionary artist Alberto Giacometti. Details at Beckler.org. And Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates, treatment of spine and brain disorders for North Mac and Lake Norman residents at its Huntersville office. Neurosurgeons, physiatrists, and physical therapy. Carolina Neurosurgery.com. Well, UNC Charlotte's Dr. James Tabor has spent a lot of his professional life researching and writing about the historical Jesus and participating in archaeological excavations, which have brought him to new and sometimes controversial conclusions. And now he has turned his attention to Paul, the man Dr. Tabor calls the most influential human in history. He joins us to talk about that tomorrow at 9.
On the next I Am Ream show, many Americans believe U.S. financial markets are rigged against individual investors. New leadership at the SEC and the agency's role in regulating Wall Street.
Join the Diane Ream Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting in our Spirit Square studio today with Mel Chin, artist in residence at McCall Center for Visual Arts and the force behind the $100 Bill Project, which is also part of Operation Paydirt, trying to clean up the lead pollution in the soil in New Orleans and other places around the country, and involving children and involving human beings, people from all over the country. You call this the largest democratic art project in history.
Well, we would hope that others would supersede it, but our ambition is to have everybody who wants to contribute can contribute a drawing. Mm. A drawing of currency the way they see it, in the form of like $100. It's a fundred, like for having fun and to fund something. In times of economic distress, you know, we felt that that would be the proper way to go.
So what you're doing, you're asking children particularly, but I guess adults could be involved in this too, to go to this website, fundred.org, mm-hmm. and you can download a template that you can use as the fundamental basis to design your own currency.
Exactly. I mean, you don't have to follow any of the rules, but you can also, as a school or an organization, order like 100 templates for just mm-hmm. the price of the postage. We pay the printing. Okay. Because the value of having expression be represented is how do you tackle something that's invisible? It's not visible. Well, you do visualize money, and this is one way of dealing with it. The problem is lead pollution affects so many of us, and the children that we're going for, we're not targeting children specifically, other than allowing them to have a say in something that affects them most dramatically.
Mm-hmm. And this has been going on since when?
This has started in 2008.
Okay, so in the time since 2008 to today, how many $100 bills have been created?
Well, we've had 400,000 that have been created originally, and more are flooding in every day. We have thousands so far coming in from the McCall Center, mm-hmm. and I hear that my fee, I gave up my fee instead. I'd take fundreds instead for my talk for a few dollars more at the University of Charlotte.
Yes, and you're speaking at 12:30 tomorrow at McKnight Hall.
Yeah, and it's rumored that they have 3,800 fundreds ready for me.
So to get in, you bring a created piece of
currency. You can, and some have already been you draw one. You draw one.
Oh, yes.
That's the mission.
Right.
But, you know, the issue of this is when I was in New Orleans mm-hmm. and I discovered this problem that affected so many children in the inner city childhood population there. And then I asked, well, how much is being dedicated on a national level or on a local level to solve this problem? And they said none. And I said that did not feel like that was defensible.
Yeah.
And then so to – rather than react with a protest movement, I thought the best way to do it is to make our own.
So how do you turn several $100 bills that are created and have no legal standing as currency into 300 million actual dollars that can be spent on cleaning up lead pollution?
Well, there's more than just creating it. I mean, we also have been working with scientists to create protocol to address the problem, create solutions that can be supported. And the idea of this would be if we were to have 3 million or more than 3 million, we could take those and ask for the even exchange for something that, like in this case, you could turn over that value back to your own agency, who was given a method to transform neighborhoods in a city and proven it so.
I'm not following you.
Well, we created a protocol with scientists that we gave to the EPA when they called the Operation Pay Dirt Funded Project, mm-hmm. and say, we have a condition that's similar to what you've been facing in New Orleans, mm-hmm. where we have children coming out of this neighborhood poisoned, and we want to know what you can do because we can no longer afford to dig up the entire neighborhood and dump it in some other territory. So we said, well, let's give you a protocol. We spent 2 years informing of how to address that problem so you can apply it. So we gave it away. It's about giving away something that is not artists invented, mm-hmm. but by scientists, and also getting up plans of prevention and educational projects that can be implemented.
But I take it it's also a way to raise awareness, because if you deliver, and you've been going around the country with an armored truck that is has been retrofitted to run on what, reclaimed cooking oil?
Well, yes, because we're going to schools. We've done that already. We've done that. We've gone those miles, and we felt like the best way to go keep it going is to stop at the cafeteria and get the cooking oil from the school and then pick up the drawings as well.
So if you're going to pick up these drawings of $100 bills and you have hundreds of thousands of these that you're ultimately going to deliver to Congress – that shows interest to Congress. That's what raises awareness of a problem that people have an interest in to people in Congress.
That correct? Is, yes. But it's also more than that. If think of the drawing not just about expression, but think of it as almost like a vote of saying that
right.
I choose
yes.
to not live in a condition that poisons me. Mm-hmm. I'm 7 years old, mm-hmm. and I prefer that not to be.
Have you or anybody else you know of ever done anything quite like this?
Well, you know, I kind of think of it not as me doing it, mm-hmm. but it is a concept that is absolutely conditional on everyone doing it. And so it's a concept that is about action that is not about me solving the problem, but us solving the problem. So maybe we live in a transformative time, and the arts are transforming as well,
okay.
where it's not just about my expression. But sometimes when you're confronted by such a huge threat to the populations across America, then as a conceptualist, you think of something that we can do together.
In some of your artwork, and this is illustrative of this, you have turned your attention to political issues. This is kind of a political issue, although it's also a health issue. Explain that in yourself, because it seems to me that you are, in a way, an activist. You're somebody who cares about certain things, and you want those things to be addressed. Why did you become an artist? Why not a writer? Why not a politician?
Well, you know, I am an artist, so I don't.
That's who you are.
Yeah,
period.
I don't prefer to go into those fields. And it's not, to me, a definition of art is a catalytic structure that gives options where none are available. And with that definition, then I'm ready to go into situations that, well, let's have an option to do this, that we can have generation upon generation to continue to be poisoned by lead in their homes and the soil and dust like this, or we choose to do something, an option. And then when you find that no options exist or are limited, then that becomes a cause that you can probably get into.
You just said something that I don't think I've ever heard anybody else say on this program, that you are an artist. And by that, I think you mean that's who you are. You were born an artist. It developed over years, but it was in you from the beginning. You see the world in a different way than a non-artistic person might
well,
see it. Am I right?
You know, I'd like to clarify that. I think you evolve into what you become, whether you're a talk show host or an artist. And there's room for evolution in a life. So far, it's taking me here. Let's say that. And I don't think that an artist is special or gifted in any other profound way other than maybe having some delusions like all of us that we're special. Mm-hmm. And I think being an artist maybe is more about being linked to the world, that you are more common than you imagine, that human expression is something that is gifted to all of us and impossible to all of us. And I just choose to continue on that track.
You're also, as I understand it, bringing together environmental scientists, landscape architects, community groups, and civic leaders to help New Orleans and other cities with similar problems. How are all these different kinds of people with different professions working together?
Well, first of all, it's not about an artist coming to solve the problems alone, or all these artists that are now 400,000 strong. Mm-hmm. To get solutions to work, we have to remove ourselves of being like the one that can cure it all, but work in more a collaborative framework, because it will take all those things: healthcare professionals, social scientists, criminologists, scientists that are involved with toxicology, to come together to provide a unified statement about how to approach this. It's not my expertise, and it's good to know that it's not. And then find the ones and be the convener of those who can deliver a solution that is supportable.
How many other cities might benefit from this if this New Orleans effort gains traction and attention at a congressional level and money is devoted to it? How many other cities might benefit?
Every city in America that has a house painted before 1978.
So that makes every city in America.
Yes, that is correct. And every community that might have had a highway that was built over them, because tetraethyl lead was used from the 20s to the 80s. So it's like that's why the project has definitely enlarged beyond New Orleans. It had to enlarge beyond New Orleans because we went across the country and we have evolved to understand, and the people of New Orleans understand, that if the solution can begin there or in Oakland or in Cincinnati or in Charlotte, then great. That's a possibility that we don't have yet. So when we talk about creation, let's talk about creation that occurs from a joint effort of people understanding a problem, what to do to prevent from it continuing, and looking at solutions to existing conditions. And this is the hope of the project.
How have you been getting the word out? How do young people, students, et cetera, know about this effort?
Well, to do the initial push, we went nationwide with educators, mm-hmm. art educators, and going to conferences and forming teams with teachers, principals, and having them carry it out within their community, and then we would follow up mm-hmm. with that. Now we're looking at we're here in Charlotte because we're investigating this concept of a free bank. You know, if you want to do a bank, you better go to where they are, you know. And the free bank is the Federal Reserve Even Exchange Bank of America. And it's just a conceptual approach. But instead of we want to invest more, have more investment, then we should have more funders. But also you want trustees that are part of this very community that's a little different. Mm-hmm. That's why we could have medical experts, scientists, be part of our new form of trustees.
You have a vault? I mean, where are you storing these hundreds of thousands of funded dollars?
It is at a secret location. But actually, it is in Philadelphia, and the home of the original Mint. We have a location that keeps them under watch. Here in Charlotte, I think they're secure at the McCall Center for the visual
arts.
And
at what point will all of this be dumped on the front lawn at on Capitol Hill?
Well, dumping is not what we have in mind. I think it would be very much a ceremony that we're, in fact, at the center, we are planning to building a oak and bronze and gilded oak and bronze and silk palette so they can be rested on something very impressive. Uh-huh. But more than the ceremony, we want to back it up with all the, you know, on top of 7,000 pounds of drawings.
Wow.
We want to lay down the protocols that we have discovered that will alleviate this problem and methods of prevention that can be unified from this group of trustees that we bring together while we're here.
It is not too late to get involved in this yourself. You can still go to fundred.org and download the template. You could also go to melchin.org and take a look at Mel Chin's work as an artist. He's the artist in residence at McCall Center for Visual Art, and he is speaking tomorrow at 12:30 at UNC Charlotte's McKnight Hall. You can get details about his lecture for a few dollars more. That's the title of the lecture at our website, wfae.org/charlottetalks. And do you have to have a $100 bill to get in, or can you just walk in?
Well, we'll hand you a template.
Okay. And by the time you leave.
It is voluntary. It is voluntary.
Well, good luck with this.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Mel Chin has found one way to raise awareness of an issue that is important to him, and so has our next guest. Since 2009, George Troop has been walking, really walking, from Washington State down through Oregon and California, through Arizona, New Mexico, across Texas, into the Deep South. Now, with Washington, D.C. in his sights, he makes a pit stop here in Charlotte, and we take this opportunity to find out why this man has been walking for 3 years. George Troop, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike.
You call this your pilgrimage of inspiration. Why?
Well, basically, what I'm looking to do is inspire people to take steps into living healthier lifestyles and thereby reducing the risk of cancer. Now, what I mean by that is that of 1.6 million cancers that Americans get every year, that's actually nearly 5,000 cancers that Americans are going to be diagnosed with just today, that experts warn us that at least two-thirds of these cancers can be prevented. And so, you know, we hear that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely applaud those who are looking for the cure. Yet, if we can prevent it in the first place, then it's worth it.
Yeah, you point out that a lot of the efforts that we're most familiar with deal with cure, helping to find a cure or helping to promote the finding of a cure. And your effort is one of the few that I've ever heard of. I don't think I've ever heard of another one that's talking about prevention.
Correct. I haven't heard of another one either. Well, actually, once I started doing some research, I did hear of others. But otherwise, I had heard a lot about the cure, which I think is great.
Mm-hmm.
Yet if an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, then we need to focus more on prevention. We need to focus more on living healthier lifestyles, which is that's the way to prevent cancer. Of course, we hear about tobacco cessation overall and how tobacco has a link to cancer. Mm-hmm. However, exercise and diet, stress management, those being the big three, we don't hear about those quite as much. And that's what I'm walking to emphasize is just an overall.
Of course, exercise and diet is not the end-all be-all to prevent cancer. It's certainly one of the things that goes into preventing cancer, but not all cancers will be prevented by that. So do you worry that focusing on that aspect of this may lead people to some sort of false sense of security?
Well, not at all. And I actually, basically what I tell people is I advocate sort of a seatbelt approach to life. I mean, you buckle up in the car, it reduces your risk of dying in an auto accident. That being said, or you put a helmet on a motorcyclist and he's not as likely to die in an accident. However, there is still a risk. And so buckling your seatbelt, I mean, there is potentially a risk where you could die in an auto accident. However, your chances of that go way down. And so that's what I advocate with a healthy lifestyle is basically a seatbelt approach toward healthy living, toward everyday life.
Mm-hmm. This all started, as I understand it, with your mother's death from cancer. She was 33. You were then 9. And I believe you started your walk at the age of 33. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. She died at age 33, 2 days before her 34th birthday. I began this walk at age 33, 2 days before my 34th birthday, and from the very same home, childhood home, where she last lived.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back and find out more about George Troop's walk across America. You can find out more yourself at enjoythewalk.com. But we're going to take a break and come back and find out exactly what this experience has been like. 4,000 miles on foot. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Comedy Zone, located at the North Carolina Music Factory, presenting comedy legend Bob Saget Friday and Saturday. Tickets available at cltcomedyzone.com. And Winston-Salem State University, transforming their campus along with the education that takes place there. Details at wssu.edu. The role of the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and what's needed to regulate Wall Street, the topic of the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock. This morning. By the way, Mel Chin, our guest in the first portion of our program, is speaking at UNC Charlotte's McKnight Hall tomorrow at 12:30. You can get details about that lecture for a few dollars more. That's the name of the lecture, not the price of it, at our website, wfae.org/charlottetalks. And if you want to talk about walking, now's your chance. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, and wfae.org/charlottetalks.
2012 was a very busy news year, and WFAE kept you informed on the important issues and stories that impacted your life. We're committed to doing the same in 2013 with your help. As this year draws to a close, please make a tax-deductible investment in public radio today and be entered to win a trip or two to the Azores. No pledge is necessary, but we hope you'll support WFAE this year. Call 704-549-9000 or make your gift online at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. George Troop is our guest in this segment. He's walking across America. He began his trip in 2009, is that right?
Yes.
In Vancouver, Washington State, and is on his way to Washington, D.C. He's been on the road, on his feet, since that time. You started this when you were 33 years old, 2 days before your 34th birthday. Most people in that age bracket probably would have a hard time starting that because they'd have to leave a job. You did leave a job. They'd have to leave their career aspirations. They'd have to put their family life on hold. How were you able to do it?
You know, I just kind of felt a calling from within that I needed to get up, go out and do something better for the world around me. And while many people in their 30s, they're very ambitiously pursuing a career, I'm actually ambitiously pursuing a calling in life. Mm-hmm. And so basically this is how I'm able to do it. I mean, I don't have any of, I call them the three M's, marriage, mortgage, and munchkins, basically at this point in life. And so, of course, that allows me an additional degree of flexibility to do something like this. Mm-hmm. If I had any one of those, which, you know, who knows, maybe in 5 years I have all three M's, but at this point I don't, and therefore I have the ability to do this. I have a window of opportunity, and I'm seizing that opportunity.
A lot of people say that they are too busy to exercise. You've given up so far 3 years of your life of doing pretty much nothing else but exercising, because walking is exercise. Mm-hmm. Is that to help people understand that, you know, 20 minutes a day or 20 minutes three times a week is not a lot?
Well, yeah, I hope it has that impact, you know. And actually walking, as far as I'm concerned, anybody can carve out 20 minutes of their day. And now I understand that there are some people that have such just atrociously busy days that perhaps on, you know, this day or that day or whatever, they may not be able to eke out 20 minutes, but I'm basically advocating for a 20-minute average and for that to be a first step toward leading a healthier lifestyle. And even if people just want to start leading a healthier lifestyle by replacing sugary beverages with water, you know, anything for a first step. I advocate walking because it goes so well with the fact that I'm walking across America, for one. Mm-hmm. And also walking, you know, you don't need any special classes or equipment or exercise videos or anything like that. You just get up, go out, and take a walk.
Yeah. Are doing this also, I'm going back to your age, at a time in life when people are trying to build for the future. They're trying to build their retirement nest egg, and you walked away from a job. At some point, I guess you'll walk back toward a job. How do you think this 3-year blank in your work life resume will appear to somebody? You think this will actually be a plus because you devoted real effort to this over time?
You know, I'm convinced it's going to be a plus. I mean, as far as a blank is concerned, I am more than confident to go into any employer XYZ in the future and say, this is what I've been doing with my life in mm-hmm. recent years. Because the people that I've been meeting along the way, it's not every day that they meet someone who's decided to go ahead and leave the job and leave the money and get up and go out and do something different with life and make a radical change. And so a lot of people, they kind of open their eyes at that and say, you know, this is they tell me their dream, you know, sometimes what they dream of doing in the future or, you know, depending on their age, what they wish they would have done in years right. past. And I don't want to work for an employer that's going to criticize me for having answered this calling in my 30s. And so as far as I'm concerned, that'll make me selective. Yeah. If someone says, oh, you've just wasted time for the last 5 years, it's like, okay, well, thank you very much. I guess I don't need this job after all.
How are you eating? How are you buying shoes? Because you got to buy more than one pair of shoes to do this.
Yes.
How is this being funded?
You know, that's an excellent question. And the answer to that basically is that, okay, so I actually, you know, as long as food and shelter are provided to me, or as long as I find food and shelter, my expenses aren't much greater than I actually, surprisingly, any time in the past when I had traveled, it was at least twice as expensive to travel as it was to live at home. Vacations were very expensive. Now, though, this isn't really a vacation. Well, in fact, it's not at all. And living on the road actually is much more affordable than living at home. So I saved up a bunch of money before in starting on this endeavor, and I've actually gone into debt, and so I'm going to be about $10,000 in debt when I finish this. But otherwise, shelter, I've paid for two separate motel room stays. I've paid for maybe a handful of campground stays.
In 3 years?
Yes, in 3 years. And I actually I couldn't have predicted this before setting out on the walk, but over 90% of the time, people host me. And that's been true across the United States. And just to give you the most recent example, so Mike and Mary Zucker, they're a couple who are hosting me here in the Charlotte area, mm-hmm. very nice people. They're actually friends with a very nice couple, Bob and Chris, who hosted me in Greer, South Carolina. And so quite often people, they hear the story or they have a friend that hosted me or just, you know, any one of a number of means, and I'm hosted that way. And so the last time I slept outdoors was actually in Alabama.
What happened in Alabama?
Well, goodness, there were, through the state of Alabama, I think there were maybe three occasions that I slept outdoors. And it's just that a lot of time, usually big cities are the easiest. I mean, there are people that know that I'm coming and right. that, you know, have invited me in. But there might be little small towns along the way that
don't know.
Exactly. And so my first night in Alabama was Grand Bay, Alabama, having come in from Pascagoula, Mississippi. And it's just a tiny town, you know. Nobody was expecting me. And so I actually came into town, and there were a bunch of cars parked at the Methodist Church. And various churches have helped me, you know, with hosting along the way. And so I decided to knock on the door, and the pastor was there. He was present. They were having a meeting. And I told them what I was doing. Typically, I show a recent newspaper article, so, right. you know, there's your credibility.
Right.
And they found a place outside the church where I could sleep. And I ended up sleeping on, like, the little kids' clubhouse at the playground outside. And so, you know, and so it's like many days I walk into – it's nice to know where I'm going to end the day and, you know, with whom I may be ending the day. But there are many times that I just walk into the day, and I'm not sure where it's going to end.
So you started this walk on September 20th, 2009 in Vancouver, Washington. You've taken uh-huh. the southern route across the country, down through Oregon and California, and across the deep south desert, the desert southwest through Texas,
yes.
the deep south, and now mm-hmm. up toward Washington, D.C. How much planning did you do? How did you plan this? When you set out on foot, did you know exactly where you were going or what route you would take?
I knew that I was going to take a southern route, and actually, interestingly enough, I had initially planned on a 9-month walking timeline. So I figured, okay, 20 miles a day, 6 days a week with at least one day off, and I will make it across America in 9 months. That was my initial plan. And actually, the best decision that I've made since beginning the walk, since taking my first footsteps, has been to scrap that deadline. Walking across the Golden Gate Bridge, 2 months into the walk, I found that I had been causing myself way too much stress, both physically and emotionally, to try to keep in line with this deadline, for one. And for two, having just walked through the beautiful, magical California redwoods, mm-hmm. I had been receiving so many invitations to spend extra time and to meet people and places and just basically have an experience of walking across America, yet I was just so militant about, got to get my 20 miles. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, just by far the best decision I could have made was to scrap the deadline. So originally I was going to spend the fall going south and then the winter going across the south. So basically south from Washington State during the fall and then crossing the southern United States during the winter and then coming back up toward Washington, D.C. during the spring. Mm-hmm. So this 9-month timeline has mushroomed into 3 years. And I haven't adjusted the route, though, as far as, you know, south and then across and then back up.
What time of year did you actually cross through Arizona and New Mexico, which is the desert?
February 2010, I started my eastbound trek from Santa Monica, California. And so I made it to El Paso, just as summer 2010 was starting. And so I've had plenty of hot days. Yeah. And actually during the summers, during summers of both 2010 and 2011, I took several months off. 2012, I did walk through the summer, and it was, but still at a much slower pace. And it was Alabama and Georgia and part of Florida. And it was just atrociously hot. And, you know, but
hotter
still
than Arizona and New Mexico?
Well, the good thing about Arizona, New Mexico,
it's a dry heat.
Well, yeah. And I mean, no, it's still it's blistering hot. But the difference is that once I get underneath a tree or some form of shade, you know, it could be 30 degrees cooler in that shade.
Not in Alabama.
Not in Alabama, not in Georgia.
Yeah. Did you walk at night a lot in the hotter months, or did you walk in the daytime in the blazing sun?
There was a combination. I mean, I would try to spend the hot part of the afternoon in some shaded area, but it would just depend. I mean, there have been days that I've walked, goodness, the longest day I walked was 35 miles, and there have been days where I've walked 5 miles or less. And so if it's a relatively short day, then I can do that, you know, in the evening hours.
You've been walking for 3 years. I don't know how sedentary or how much you exercised prior to embarking on this trip you did, but how has your body changed over these last 3 years?
You know, Mike, I'm 37 years old, and I actually feel a lot healthier today than I did 10 years ago at age 27. And the reason for that, I was leading, by and large, a sedentary lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And now I'm much more active, and I eat much better quality food. And my body just feels much stronger at age 37 than it did at age 27 or 25.
You're a vegetarian, too, aren't you?
I am, yes.
How difficult has that been to keep that diet going as you go to different and strange places across the country?
You know, that's an interesting question because I walked over 1,000 miles through Texas and as a vegetarian. And so that's easy to do in the big cities because in the big cities there are always small vegetarian enclaves. But in small town America, and I would say even most recently in Clover, South Carolina, I was invited in by a nice family and they took me to one of their local diner restaurants. And the waitress, when you know, I explained to her that I was a vegetarian and that therefore ate no meat, she kind of stared at me for a second, and then she started laughing, you know, quietly to herself. And so I basically I have to be creative, and I have to ask them good questions of, okay, so do you have any rice and beans, and you know, just kind of figure out what they have that they usually put together with meat, and sort of create a meal with them, a meal plan with them, and it's always possible.
Is your being a vegetarian part and parcel of this fitness regimen that would be aimed at preventing cancer, or is this something else altogether different?
You're right on the money there, Mike. It is part of my healthier lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And it's actually just...
How long have you been vegetarian?
About 12 years now.
Okay.
Yeah, and so... That being said, I'm not a militant vegetarian. I mean, sometimes there's a myth out there that vegetarians scream at the sight of meat, and no, that's not the case. I mean, I was raised on meat for every meal for the most part for the majority of my life,
sure.
And so I'm at the table with meat all the time, and that's the true for 99% of vegetarians. There may be some militant ones, but I like vegetarianism as a healthier lifestyle choice overall.
Do you walk in all weathers? If it's a particularly cold day or a particularly wet day or a particularly hot, dry day, do you take a day off? Do you just shorten your route to walk less? Or do you just go because you have to make your 20 miles or your 20 kilometers or whatever you've projected for that day?
You know, okay, so I walk 100% of the miles, but there are times where, maybe I was going to walk a 24-mile day, and because of weather factors or other factors, that there's a town in the middle and I'm deciding to stop there for the night. Mm-hmm. So that has happened. That being said, though, during the rain, I mean, I'm from a very rainy part of the country, the Pacific Northwest, and so it's not like rain scares me or bothers me. That being said, though, I've learned over the course of the miles that a lot of cars, they're not as good a driver as a lot of times during wet conditions. And so in many of the places where I walk, people are not expecting to find pedestrians. I mean, of course, here in Charlotte or in a big city, I have sidewalks to walk on. Mm-hmm. And there are places where you expect to see pedestrians on walking paths or jogging trails. Those I can easily walk in the rain. It doesn't matter. But when I'm in the middle of two small towns and there's just some lonely 70-mile-an-hour highway, and people that drive that, highway for decades, they never see pedestrians. And suddenly I'm there around a curve on a day of low visibility and there's not much of a shoulder. I mean, it's dangerous to me. It's dangerous to them. And they don't have as much reaction time when it's wet, for one thing. And not only that, I mean, I wear glasses. Sadly, a good 3 or 4 hours of, hardcore walking, and my glasses fog up.
Right.
And so so rainy weather, I try to limit my miles in rainy weather. I don't want to do, 20-mile days in the rainy weather just because of the danger factors.
How many pairs of shoes have you been through?
I've been through 10. Well, I'm on pair number 10 right now. I actually switched to sandals when I reached Abilene, Texas. And in goodness, in days that have been below freezing and days that have been over 100 and including rainy days, I've worn the sandals all the way through and I love them.
What have you learned about yourself, about America, about people as you've done this?
You know, so about myself, I've learned about myself what's true for everyone in society is true for myself as well, that every single one of us has enormous potential in life to create a better world for ourselves and for everyone around us. Now, as far as what I've learned about America is that despite what we may see on any local given newscast about, you know, the five violent crime stories of the day,
right,
that by and large, people are, you know, 99.9% of the time, they're good people. I've walked over 4,000 miles now. I've never once been robbed. I've never been attacked. I've never been threatened. And I imagine that I'll make it the rest of the way into Washington, D.C., and the very same is going to be true.
I hope you're right. Where will you end this walk?
I'm going to be ending this walk at the White House.
Do they know you're coming?
You know, there are a couple of people that I know that have contacts with the White House, and I haven't worked on utilizing those contacts just yet because I don't want to give an exact deadline,
right,
or arrival date because, I mean, I'm kind of taking this walk one step at a time, excuse the pun. But
And what will happen when this is over, when you've gotten to the White House and it's you've put a period on the end of the sentence here, what happens to you? What do you do now?
You know, I have a number of options available to me. That being said, though, the same, I'll call it divine intuition that led me to take this walk in the first place is keeping me wide open to opportunities that may present themselves and unfold as the walk concludes.
Hmm. George Troop is walking across America, and you can find out more about his walk because technology, he blogs on a regular basis. Technology allows you to do that while you're on the road. Enjoythewalk.com is the name of that website, and you can contribute, I guess, to there as well. You're kind of like a modern-day Jack Kerouac in a way.
Well, yeah, and there's no donation link. It's just a walk of inspiration.
Thanks for being here, and good luck on the rest of your walk.
Thank you, Mike.